BCFM Radio 93.2. We're your voice. Your voice.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, which poses as the Sky News, almost sounds British, doesn't it? To the brink of war and back again. But will there ultimately be any let-up in the missile and drone strikes by the US and Israel on the forces fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria? Backed by Iran. And Iraq now too. Will the Iraqi parliament get their way and see the US troops leave Iraq? What are the key facts that have been skipped over or ignored completely by the West's mass media? Like the Iraqi Prime Minister's statement that Soleimani, the general who was killed, wasn't in Iraq to blow up the US embassy at all, but to broker a peace deal with the Saudis, which could have led even to an end to the war in Yemen. Something the US and Israel would have been rather interested in. Then there's PS752. Well, that's the flight number of the doomed Ukrainian 737, which crashed in Tehran early on Wednesday morning, 4 hours after the Iranian strikes on US bases in Iraq. Plus the CIA and America's descent into lawlessness. We look at pro-Nazi US statesman Nelson Rockefeller and his deal to get the votes Ben-Gurion needed for the UN to recognise the Israeli state back in 1948. The deal was to keep your mouth shut about the Nazi war criminals now working in the US intelligence services. You can have a country or you can have vengeance, he said, but not both. An exclusive with FBI lawyer, special investigator and author of The Secret War Against the Jews, John Loftus. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, actually clear as well, isn't it? I was having a look at this amazing moon, almost like a full moon out there tonight. Pretty much clear skies for a while anyway. Highs tonight, this weekend, of 11. And cloudy and windy tomorrow, light rain and showers on Sunday. So forget the shopping on Saturday, get out and about if you can. Sunday's looking rainy and showery. Next week, highs around 11 Celsius most of the week. Plenty of showers, occasional sunny spell and windy. Next weekend, 18th and 19th of January, highs around 7, getting cooler, but sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
First of all, let's just talk a bit about what your feelings are about the general election back in December, because it does look as if there was a pretty resounding vote for Brexit. And Jo Swinton lost her seat, didn't she? Lib Dem leader.
She did. It wasn't the greatest night for the Liberal Democrats. We're used to those nights, so we're used to bouncing back from them. Overall, I think what it was is Boris Johnson had a very clear message. I think also the difference to 2017 is he's got personality, which lets him bounce back.
It wasn't just that it was clear. It was actually what the voters wanted to hear, which is more important, isn't it?
Well, I think he had a clear message. I think it's not what every voter wanted to hear. I mean, let's be clear, the country is still divided 50-50 on the issue of Brexit, but an election has occurred. He's won a majority of seats. He gets to form the government. It's going to happen. There's many people you know, like me, who would prefer that we remain. I think now we've got to accept that's going to happen. We've got to hope for the best. You know, we don't want it to be a disaster.
Shouldn't you have done that back in 2016 when the referendum happened? And wouldn't it be better to get it behind us then? And we could have had, you know, several years of actually being out of the EU and getting on with running the country, well, getting things sorted out here. It's always very easy. Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump does this, doesn't he? He says, oh, well, there's much more bigger issues to sort out, international issues, well, that sort of thing. I would answer that,
because that's a good point. But it's Brexit supporters have held us hostage for over 3 years. Let us remember, it is Brexit supporters that brought down Theresa May's deal. They had the numbers to get it through, but instead they argued and argued and argued. And that's what it has happened. The extreme Brexiteers, the soft Brexiteers, and the soft Remainers who they recruited to their side could not agree. Because, of course, the reality is what people voted for in 2016 was about 15 million different things. Everybody had a different idea of what this Brexit was that they were voting for.
Well,
nobody was ever told clearly what it was.
Immigration was a big part of it, wasn't it?
Well, immigration was a big part of it, but they were also told that they could be like Norway. They were told that again and again and again. And of course, Norway has freedom of movement. So that they were not told. So there were lots of things they were told which were contradictory. And that has been the problem we face. Now, to be honest, we can draw a line under that. He's got a majority. He can do what he likes. He's got a group of MPs who are signed up to his deal. I think it's a bad deal for the country, but it's going to occur. Throughout this process, we will try to provide suggestions on how it could be approved. We as Liberal Democrats, will always remain committed to the idea of internationalism, where it works for our country. And we think that the EU did. But it is clear we are leaving. You know, he's got the numbers, and there's no point trying to pretend he hasn't.
Well, I'll give Martin a bit of notice, because I'll be asking him this question as well in a minute. But what do you make of the contenders for Labour leader? I mean, I don't see any, you know, the sort of past heavyweights of the Labour Party, particularly, you know, now that if the country is going to go pro-Brexit, they could do with somebody who's actually going to get on board and been on board with that from the start, rather than the Tories, because the Tories have got Boris, who was he famously wrote two columns, didn't he? So he could be both or either pro or anti-Brexit. I mean, if we're going to see something in the future, the Labour Party, I mean, they've got 5 years, and you, helping them or hindering them, have got 5 years to bring Boris down. And they need a leader that's going to be able to do that in that next 5 years, not just an also-ran.
Well, here's the truth I reveal to you that Liberal Democrats who are involved in campaigning know, and that's the Liberal Democrats only do well when Labour have got an electable leader. It is in the interests of people who are left of centre that Labour choose a leader that those people who are left of centre and also middle ground can get behind. So I hope that Labour members will consider that when they're going to go and vote. Now, I won't have a vote, not surprisingly, in the Labour leadership contest. And I'm taking a look at some of the names putting themselves forward. And occasionally, I do wonder what planet some of these people are on. But there are clearly one or two names put forward who are, I think, reasonably sensible, who would be able to build a coalition around them. The reality is, in 4 or 5 years' time, in 2024, which I think is probably when the next general election will be, Liberal Democrats and Labour will be contesting for very few seats against each other. We are mostly now quite divided in the country on where we will be contesting, and we'll be contesting the Conservatives. It may take two elections to remove them. It is essential, I think, Labour choose a leader who they think can build that coalition across the left of politics. And that may even include in the future sort of not necessarily working with the Liberal Democrats, but very much where we were with Tony Blair in 96, where we had a common enemy.
What about your own party? Who's going to be your next leader? Who are you going to be going for?
Good question. Choices are slightly more limited than in the Labour leadership, which makes it a bit easier.
I'm just looking at William Hill here, so I'll be interested to see what you say.
I did not vote for Ed last time round. I may vote for Ed this time round. I'm hoping to get a chance to get to know who the contenders will be. I mean, there's probably three main ones: Ed Davey, Leila Moran, and Daisy Cooper. All three.
Well, you've got them just in the row, just as William Hill do, the political betting people. Anyway, Martin, the Labour, the betting for Labour leader is number one is Keir Starmer. And the trouble is, he's a sort of quite an establishment figure, isn't he? As there are some of these odds-checking websites, that sort of thing. I'll put a link up on our show page because it's actually quite interesting to see the way these things change over the weeks. Rebecca Long-Bailey coming in at 2 and some of them as number 1. But what do you make of the lineup? Are you satisfied? Are you happy that you've got a great bunch of people to choose from?
One of the early people to throw their hat in the ring was Clive Lewis. And one of the things he said is we've got to talk about PR. And for me, that's absolutely crucial.
Isn't this the Labour Party giving up on the idea of being one of the main parties?
Well, let's put it this way. In 5 years' time, Scotland may not be voting inside a UK general election anyway. And we've got a split, splits about Brexit still going on.
Well, you can't count on that, can you?
No, we can't. We're not counting on anything, Tony. You're asking me what we're going to do.
You need someone who's going to get Boris out in 5 years' time.
We need somebody who's in favour of proportional representation. Let's come back to what happened on December the 12th. A majority of people...
You didn't like the system.
No, a majority of people in the UK voted for Remain or people who want a second referendum parties. Because of the electoral system that the Irish went to war to change in 1969, the majorities have got a majority of 80.
Is Clive Lewis the only one in favour of PR?
No, he's the only one who's come out in favour of it, firmly in favour of it. So I emailed him to say, good, glad you've said that. I don't think he's a favourite too.
I mean, we've had him today saying that there should be a referendum on the royal family, and then he's had to backtrack. So it was on that Sky News bulletin, and actually within the last hour or so, he's been told by the Labour apparatchiks, no, you can't do that. And so he's had to backtrack. We've also seen Jess Phillips saying there's going to be a second vote on the EU if she becomes Labour leader, and she's had to backtrack on that too. So it doesn't sound as if these leaders are really actually able to say what they think should be done. It seems that the Labour Party itself is trying to rein them in all the time.
Well, I'm not going to comment on any particular statements that you've just made there, Tony. The fact is there's quite a wide field. It's actually wide open. It's not straightforward who's going to win. I can live with Keir Starmer, but you've got to remember he definitely is pro-EU. And of course, the only way we're going to finesse this, in my mind, is if we commit to proportional representation so we can form a progressive alliance as we've got in New Zealand for the last 20 or 30 years. It's been, it's not me newly saying this. I've said this on this show for the last 10 years, Tony, week in, week out.
Isn't part of the problem that there's so many people like you in the Labour Party that want to tell the voters what to think and then persuade the voters to vote for you? You don't actually listen to what the voters want.
No, the voters, as I said, on December the 12th, in their majority, Tony, and it only matters to have a majority of one when we're talking about
things like
this. So you're
saying, like Jeremy Corbyn said, oh, well, actually, we won the argument, we just lost the
election. No, it's not, because the electoral system means that the Tories have got a majority of 80 on a 1% increase of their vote. Now, that's not right. It wasn't right in 1969 in Belfast, and it's not right now, especially when a big decision like this is coming forward. And, of course, the real question now is what kind of Brexit we're going to get. And we're going to get a no-deal Brexit, that's quite clear, which means that car factories like Ellesmere Port are definitely going to close. And when those car factories close, we're going to turn around to the people who said that was a good idea and say, you think this is such a good idea now?
Martin, you're blurring fact and speculation there, aren't you? Because it's not necessarily going to be a no-deal Brexit.
I think that's completely wrong.
Why do you say we are definitely going to have a no-deal Brexit?
The reason I say that is because the majority of the Conservative Party in Parliament want a no-deal Brexit. That's pretty clear. And the reason why they've said they're not going to extend the transition period beyond next December is because they want a no-deal Brexit. They want to do a trade deal with Boris.
The reason he's doing it is because he wants it all over with.
No, what he's doing is he's saying, I'm doing this because it puts pressure on the EU to do a deal on our terms. In actual fact, the EU look at it the opposite way. The Irish look at it the opposite way. No, you're not going to get a deal out of us, because the Irish, of course, have now been cut out of the deal anyway. So the Scots are going to say we want the same deal the Irish have got, quite obviously. And of course, the other issue is the trade deal with the Americans. I'm going to oppose tooth and branch any trade deal with the Americans. We don't want courts deciding.
Do we not want to trade with them?
If we're going to leave the EU, it's about having sovereignty, Tony. And that means we're not doing trade deals with anybody. It's WTO rules, even
that
the WTO.
That sounds to me like you're
drain.
Cutting off your nose to spite your face.
No, we're not having a trade deal with the US based on the trade, like the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, where unelected courts can decide against British government policy. We're not having it. And of course, the Tories will go for it. And we will turn around to the electorate and say, look at that. They've just handed the sovereignty to the United States.
Well, we shall see. What do you make of all this, particularly with the US? Because it does look as if by saying no to Brussels, we may be saying yes to Washington.
Well, obviously, in one sense, the focus of the country could change. And certainly that's what has been put to us again and again, that we can get this great deal from the US. I guess people have got to ask themselves a question. Why will we be able to get such a great deal from the US, which the EU, which is, of course, 5 to 6 times our size, that deal everyone thought was really, really bad, the TTIP deal. So you begin to sort of ask yourself, are we being sold here a fairy tale? And I fear that we probably are. I think the reality is where the US want to push things is around their pharmaceuticals. It's our massive industry in the United States. They want to push up the prices of pharmaceuticals. And that's already been sort of clear. It's been a big element they've tried to push. So I think sometimes we get lost in the argument of they want to take over the NHS. There are a lot more. There's a lot more finesse to this here. They're a lot more strategic. They go out there after certain, on behalf of certain industries, the pharmaceutical industry, obviously the agriculture industry. These are sort of the ones they are pushing, and this is where we really must be quite worried. I'm a little bit more hopeful actually that we won't hit a no deal break. I just think I think Boris has been playing a bit of a clever game of pretending to be a Brexiteer, and I think perhaps in 6 to 9 months' time his line will soften a great deal, and in reality they will abandon a lot of those hard lines they've made out to come forward with probably a closer trading partnership with the EU than they are making out that they're going to have at this point.
Well, what do you make of Jeremy Corbyn's refusal to back any of the candidates? I was quite surprised to see that, because there's obviously, I mean, he's brought a lot of new people into the party, and yet, I mean, he's got quite a lot of cachet. If he was to point at one of them and say, actually, this person, I'd endorse them, I think you should vote for them, it would almost certainly increase, unlike the Tony Blair factor, which might actually have the opposite effect. Surely Corbyn should be at least endorsing somebody and saying, I think this is the best person to take over from me.
Well, I guess the thing is the Labour membership is fairly split, isn't it, between sort of half who are more aligned with the left and perhaps newer members, half who are perhaps older Labour members and perhaps more aligned with the Tony Blair years. And if he endorses one candidate, yes, he may help get a few more votes, but to be honest, those people will probably coalesce around a candidate they already see as representing their views, but he would then put off potentially voters from the other camp who might still be willing to connect with that candidate. I do agree that PR is our electoral system is the problem here. Our electoral system is designed around just two big camps, two big beasts that go to election, and it works fine then. But actually, people want more complicated choices in their life. They don't want to just choose between A and B, and that's of course what proportional representation allows for. And that's why virtually no democracy, there are a few, of course America being one of the big ones, do not touch first past the post with a barge pole, because they see its limitations. That's why the vast majority of Europe uses PR, because what it does is it allows politicians and political parties to go out there with a true manifesto that they believe in. Does sometimes mean at the end you get more coalitions, but you actually get then to be more pure in what you can offer to the electorate.
And we had a vote about this, didn't we? Was it in 2010, I think, about the alternative vote, which was moving towards PR, and it was rejected by the public.
Oh, we did. And as you know, Tony, of course, we also had a vote about the European Union in 1975, but those people in favour of Brexit completely forgot that in 2016 and demanded another vote. So it doesn't mean because you have a vote one time, you can't have a vote again in the future. I certainly accept you shouldn't have vote after vote
Martin, get what you want. The people missing from the list of candidates for the Labour leaders, there's nobody there of the stature of somebody like Robin Cook or of John Smith or a Barbara Castle, somebody like that. There's just nobody there. They all, I mean, for example, I mean, I don't know, Keir Starmer, to me, I find very unconvincing. He looks to me a bit too much like Tommy Cooper. He's got that sort of Tommy Cooper look, a kind of vacant stare that I can't understand how anybody thinks that he'd make a great leader. He's just not convincing. He doesn't seem to have any passion.
Well, that's a personal statement by you. I think in actual fact people respecting Rebecca Long Bailey to be the favourite. I waited for her statement to come out, and I noticed with dismay that there was no mention of PR in it. For me, that's an absolutely crucial thing. And it's crucial. And if we look at what happened in New Zealand in the 1980s,
well, Martin, we've been through this. We've just been through all this. Martin, we've just been through all this. Okay, so for the last 10 minutes.
All right.
Well, can you answer the question I put to you, which is, where are the Robin Cooks, the John Smiths?
Well, Robin Cook's dead, as you well know, and so is John Smith. And in actual fact, what happens is new generations come forward, and most people haven't heard of them, apart from people who follow the minutiae of politics, like the people who listen to this show and the people on it. Most people don't know who most of these people are.
You don't seem to get my point, which is there's nobody of that stature.
Well,
so I just want to point out, in 1993, no one had ever heard of Tony Blair.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, I mean, you know, new politicians do rise up. Obviously, Labour have not been in power for 9 years. So, in reality, if you're going to go for a new face, they will be less known.
I mean, for example, John McDonnell.
The beginning of the electoral
John McDonnell, system. He's quite well known. He's quite popular. Yeah. He said, "Oh, I'm not going to stand." Well, and then we've also got Angela Rayner. She's also very popular, quite a good at thinking on her feet. She's not interested in being leader. She's been told,
she hasn't been told anything, deputy leader. She's friendly with Rebecca Long Bailey, and they've got a pact that she won't stand against her. That's what's happened there. And McDonald, I think, quite rightly, has said, "I've had my go. It's not fair to me come forward and say, you know, Martin
it's,
Corbyn,
to be fair,
Mark
it
two,
sounds,
me,
it sounds
you know.
She has been told by Rebecca Long Bailey, "Don't stand against me."
No, well, of course, the left are trying to unite around one candidate. Clive Lewis is of the left, so in a sense, him standing actually potentially split the vote. But of course, there's a process whereby it'll be narrowed down to two at the end anyway. I've already been in communication with Fangham about what I want to see, and I want to see somebody, at least one person on that ballot paper, committed to PR. I'd prefer both of them to be committed to PR from both sides of the party.
Martin, we know that. You've said that about for the last 10 minutes. But anyway,
what
about last week's? Last week, you weren't here, Martin, but we were discussing a statement by Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, which was part of his endorsement of Jeremy Corbyn on the day of the general election back in December, where he was talking about watermelon smiles and pickaninnies, implying that Boris Johnson was using these racist expressions to smear people of ethnic minorities. Well, I just think it would be quite useful to clear up what he's referring to is an article by Boris Johnson. And I actually read the article. This is from about 2010, the article. And the reference to watermelon smiles and pickaninnies is really taking the mickey, really, out of the royal family, the way they go around and pretend that they're some sort of friends to the, you know, actually, what one of the things he's talking about, the watermelon smiles for the big white chief in his big white aeroplane. Now, this is not actually a racist use
Isn't
of
it?
The language.
Isn't it?
No.
I'll dispute that too.
Well, it's not. No, he's saying that this is the sort of attitude that the royal family have when they go around to other countries. He's certainly not using it in a racist context. Using it against ethnic minorities at all.
Letterboxes and bank robbers, Tony?
Well, that's not what this is about.
I think we've got a legitimate concern with his views about race. I'm sorry, we just have.
What do you make of that anyway, Tim?
I've not read the article you've referred to. I've certainly heard. I've heard.
What
the
I'll
words
do is I'll put a link up
often.
To clear things up. I'll put a link up on our show page to the original article.
No, you make a good
which
point.
Which is thisweek.org.uk.
That quite often things can be taken out of context in politics. I've not read the original article, so I don't want to talk about that. But I think what we've seen in the past is Boris Johnson skates on very thin ice when it comes to use of language like this. He does this intentionally, more to get media attention, to get people talking about him. I doubt very much that at heart he's a raving racist at all. But I think what he's perfectly aware of is that sometimes if you're controversial, you get cut through. And I think that's what he has done in the past. And sometimes I'm worried that's what he might do in the future, because actually that's not good for the long term for this country, because that's what causes division. And actually where this country is at its best, where is it at its strongest, is actually when we're united.
United under the great royal family. And this week we hear all sorts of divisions going on. Nice to see you saluting there, Tim. I better salute too, I suppose, and stand up straight. Because there seems to be a few fissures in the royal family this week. Martin, does it matter when we get these spats within the royal family, or are they just, you know, irrelevant?
Well, it's not irrelevant because it's part of the zeitgeist of what's going on and people pick up on it.
Do they have any power?
Well, they have, yeah, indirectly they have a lot of power, but it's not exercised in the way that that it used to be in the past. Thank
goodness. Have a tremendous amount of privilege. This is the point, yeah. I think, is that you've got literally millions of pounds rolling in of I think it's from the Duchy of Cornwall specifically to Harry and Meghan, and in a way they are kind of locals because they do spend a lot of time up in Highgrove, which is just up near Tetbury here, just about half an hour's drive away. Anyway, what do you make of this, Tim? This, the Sussexes, the idea is that they want to split off from the royal family, become a kind of brand, but keep the Royal Highness, HRH brand, and go commercial.
I mean, yes, they have a life of privilege, but they also have a life where basically you're in a gilded cage. I perfectly understand that they want to live their own life. I think if that's the case, they should be allowed to do that. I think with that also comes the need that, they don't then live off the public purse if they're going to be private and do their own thing. I am still a monarchist. I believe the royal family brings something to the country. I'm also very, very concerned if we ever went down the presidential style, what we would end up with. Having said that, it is all with the consent of the public. And I guess the concern the royal family has here is that this is quite a sort of immediate change for the public to take on board. It does appear that there is a rift. I think a lot of people wrongly blame Meghan. I suspect this is far more Harry, who's never actually been happy or comfortable within those royal duties. Let's remember, he went off, he joined the army, he did everything he could to avoid being part of this sort of royal setup. I think, as soon as he left the army, he did exactly the same thing. He went off around the world to promote charities. I don't think he's comfortable in that role, and I don't think he should in any way be forced to live it. At the same time, that's fine, but it shouldn't be for the public to subsidise that. Of course, the Duchy of Cornwall technically is not part of the royal estate. It's actually a private estate of the Duke of Cornwall, and it also is under the Cornish charters. So it does actually mean that technically you can't even tax it.
Oh, that's handy. It sounds a bit like the Merchant Venturers, where we're not allowed to know anything much about what their accounts are. Martin, we've heard Piers Morgan has tweeted about this. He's spent quite a lot of time being critical of Meghan Markle. And I suppose, there are questions about whether that is motivated by racism. Some people think it is. But he says, people say I'm too critical of Meghan Markle, he tweeted a couple of days ago. But she's ditched her family. She's ditched her dad, ditched most of her old friends, split Harry from William, and has now split him from the royal family.
Well, I don't really rate Piers Morgan, I have to be honest with you. I don't really care what he thinks.
Well, what about what he's saying there? Because he's basically saying that the splits have been going on. I mean,
it's inevitable. I mean, there are actually splits in my family, which I could discuss on air, but I don't particularly want to.
Well, you're not the royal family.
Well, indeed, but the point
is
I do sympathise with living in what Tim has called the gilded cage. And I think, it's very difficult for them. And of course, at the same time, we're all drawn into this, EastEnders psychodrama, whatever it is. And in many ways, we can identify with the royal family because they're as dysfunctional as everybody else's family.
Well, I was quite interested.
We can kind of identify with that and say, yes, of course, that's just like what goes on in my family.
It was quite weird before. I think it was about September, October last year. I was up in Tetbury just doing a little bit of shopping in Tesco's, and this great big Black Range Rover turned up and skidded to a halt right on the zebra crossing, and Harry jumped out and went to the cash point, and I've never heard a cash point whirring, making so much noise for so long. I don't know how much money he took out in cash, but then he jumped back in his Land Rover and was off again. But I mean, these they are local people. They do seem to have a sense, don't they, Martin, that they are in charge of everything, and they're completely invulnerable to do whatever they want effectively.
Well, I think in actual fact, so far as they've done there, I mean, they've come to the boxing club down the road here. They've gone out of their way to sort of show a kind of more modern face to the royal family.
The trouble is with the royal family is every now and again it throws up a Henry VIII, doesn't it?
Well, every now and again, don't forget they were not supposed to marry commoners and all the rest of it. You know, this is what the marriage, you know, all the stuff with Mrs. Simpson and so on. I mean, fundamentally, if we're going to
keep... We'll be talking about that later, by the way.
If we're going to keep a monarchy, we need to have one like in Norway. The Norwegian monarchy, I think, is really a very, very respectable institution. For example, after the shootings at Utøya, King Harald did a very good job in Oslo Cathedral of pulling the country together. And, of course, they've got a much more stripped-down monarchy in Scandinavia. You see the Queen in Holland riding around on her bike and so on. It's not quite the same as what we've got here. And, of course, the royal family are linked into the whole historical nonsense in this country, the House of Lords, the electoral system, I hate to bring it up, the whole thing of the Tories being in power forever, the Eton College running everything because it's all basically rigged, and the cherry on the top of that is the royal family. Now, of course, in other countries where they've had occupations by the Germans during the war in Norway, the royal family fled to England and refused to go along with the occupation authorities. I wonder what happened here.
Back to the general election, and I came across this clip from a guy called Joe Glassman, who is one of the bosses of something called the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. He describes Jeremy Corbyn as the decircumciser, and he was one of the people who was part of the campaign against anti-Semitism, basically not to get Jeremy Corbyn elected, which I found quite surprising because the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism is a charity, and I didn't think that charities were supposed to campaign in that sort of political way. Can you just say something, Martin, about what the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism is?
Well, I don't know exactly what they are, but it seems extraordinary that they can, if they are a charity, campaign against the election. Of course, I understand that some of them are members of the Labour Party, and you're not supposed to do that either. If just under Labour Party rules. Underlying all of this is hostility to Jeremy Corbyn's opposition to the State of Israel's annexation of Palestinian land, just as I was opposed to the annexation of Bosnian land by the Serbs, and we went to war with them, if you remember. Is it anti-Semitic or anti-Serbian to say that people shouldn't do land grabbing?
Okay,
or is land grabbing okay?
Let's have a listen now to Joe Glassman. This is his Christmas statement saying congratulations for stopping Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister.
My name's Joe Glassman. Some of you know me, but whether you do or not, I just wanted to take this moment at Hanukkah to say a purely personal thank you to every single person out there who actively resisted the anti-Semitism of Corbyn and the Labour Party and say, well done, Mazel Tov. Just to put me into context, if you don't know, I'm a volunteer at Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, where I head the political investigations team, which, among other things, was responsible for our successful submission to the AHRC. But today, I'm not speaking in that role. I'm just speaking as one more person who volunteered like you, because the Hanukkah miracle has happened. The beast is slain, and I have an urge to express my love and personal gratitude to every single person, some of whom I've never met, who've played their part, and wish them a Hanukkah or maybe Chrismaka Sameach. Yeah, we've had to deal with those cool Greeks, young Corbynista Jewish outriders, desperate decircumcisers, who tried to cast people like me, who used to vote Labour, as some kind of right-wing Trump fanatics, robbing the poor of a better future. So Corbyn was not Haman or Hitler, he was Antiochus the extremely humorless, and we defeated him. And really, if we could see off the might of ancient Greece, it's not surprising we could see off what Stephen Daisley called a rancid Tony Benn revival act. Inevitably, those Greeks, as they did then, will come back for Jerusalem. So none of us should be ready to beat our swords into plowshares just yet. But Maccabees, we did it. By word and deed, by protest and tweet, by our spies and intel, by our fab celebrities and our anonymous volunteers. And if Jerusalem is builded here in England's green and pleasant land, then just for now, at least, we have our Jerusalem back. Maccabees at ease. They tried to kill us. We won. Let's eat. And to quote our other Jewish festival of liberation, not leaning too far to the left. L'chaim.
So that's Joe Glassman, Martin. Very happy that the anti-Semite Corbyn was not elected Prime Minister.
Well, indeed, and he's entitled to his views, and he clearly, one of his views is that Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel. That's not the view of the British government, even under its current incarnation, or anybody else.
But he's talking about actually building it here in England's place.
All right, well, we could argue about what he actually means by Jerusalem there. I think it's quite, we've got our spies and our intel. It's funny you should mention that, because we know, because of the sting carried out by Al Jazeera, that the Israeli embassy had £1 million to spend inside the Labour Party in this country to get the results they wanted. And of course, the same people who were caught in that sting were then put on a panorama programme as aggrieved Labour Party staffers who were going on about the anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. But it's quite clear they were working directly with the Israeli embassy all along.
And in actual fact, they're entitled to do that.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
They're spies, Tony. As he said, spies. Of course, what we're really talking about here is the annexation of the West Bank, the annexation of the Golan Heights, and the annexation of Jerusalem. Just like the annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Are you saying that Israel is not under threat?
Israel is a threat to the rest of the Middle East. They've got nuclear weapons that they're not supposed to have. And under the Logan Act in the US, if they admitted they'd got them, they'd be under sanctions.
Yeah, but they're surrounded by Arab nations, aren't they?
Yes, because they chose to go there. But the Arab nations were there in the first place. I'm not saying that the state of Israel hasn't got a right to exist. It got a right to exist within the borders of 1948. So that's what was agreed.
How do you feel
just
about
like Serbia's got a right to exist within its borders,
so how
but
do you,
it cannot
how do you
aggress
feel
its neighbours?
About a campaign against anti-Semitism, putting out a statement saying, Jeremy Corbyn, the beast is slain.
Well, the person who said that Jeremy Corbyn was a Tony Benn tribute band was, I believe, the current Prime Minister. And now we're going to have 5 or possibly 10 years of neoliberal chaos in this country, including possibly being dragged to war with Iran to keep the Americans and the Israelis happy. And let's see how everybody's cheering when that comes around, eh?
What do you make of what you've heard, Tim? Particularly this whole sort of, I mean, it's sort of triumphant thing. The beast is slain. The anti-Semite is no more. And this is a successful campaign by the campaign against anti-Semitism. That's the way they see it.
I don't know the gentleman for the clip that you just played. Obviously, his views seem pretty extreme to me, and I think that is the problem here. People have got themselves wound up into very extreme views. We must recognise that there are a lot of normal Jewish people very, very concerned. I think, you know, we need to recognise that. We need to also recognise that there has been a problem within certain elements of the Labour Party. I'm no way accusing the vast majority of Labour members of being anti-Semitic. And I think actually many of those people who even use unwise language probably are not anti-Jewish at all in their beliefs, and I've got very, very confused. The danger here is those people who are anti-Semitic, those people who do hate Jewish people, are basically see this as giving them permission to revel in their hate. And that's where we must be very, very, very careful about any anti-Semitic language. And we must be very careful in when we raise perfectly legitimate concerns about some of the actions of the state of Israel, especially towards the Palestinians and the Palestinian state, and also whether or not they are living up to internationally recognized agreements or not, and then mixing that up with Jewish people. And too often, what we saw even in the general election itself were some Labour members abusing people who were out campaigning against Labour because of what they saw as anti-Semitism, throwing at them statements about Israel. Israel has nothing to do with them. They're British citizens, and they should have recognised that. So I think, you know, all sides have got to roll back here. Everyone's got to reflect. I think, you know, what that gentleman just said there was extreme. Personally, I think that is nearly as extreme as some of the other views we've heard from the other side. It is important that we, you know, as a country, we roll back from extremism. Over the last 5-10 years, we've seen extremism take too much hold in our country, whether that is anti-Semitism, whether that is radicalized and violent Islam, whether that is the far right. And what we must remember is those people are an extreme minority within our population. Too often we talk about it, we think they're the norm. They're not the norm. They're trying to convince us they are. And so all I say is, in no way should people think that the views of the extremists hold weight in this country. They do not.
And Martin, just to make things more awkward, Bristol City Councillor suspended from the Labour Party, subject of an anti-Semitism complaint. Harriet Bradley has been suspended from the party in December after she shared a post on her Facebook page with the message, "The right kind of Jews, i.e. left voters."
Well, I'm not going to comment on an individual case like that. That will be dealt with by the internal procedures of the party. Although I must say that we're not very confident that that's actually going to be... You know, there's been basically a lot of people have been persecuted under this anti-Semitism label, who's definitely not anti-Semitic in my view.
Well, to put it in like a bit of context, let's just do a bit of context. The post from Jewish Voice for Labour, which she shared, shows two elderly men holding JVL signs, one of which reads, "Jews for Jeremy."
Well, yes, and of course what she said is the right kind of Jews, apparently, and of course that does imply that there's a wrong kind of Jews. But I think the other side have been talking about that. You see the guy you quoted earlier, he was going about these so-called Jews, the decircumcisers, the ones who don't want us to be Jewish anymore. In actual fact, circumcision is going to be discussed in the Icelandic parliament as a possible... they're going to ban it unless you're an adult, a bit like female circumcision. Now, that's a bit of an extreme position, and I wouldn't necessarily go there. And, of course, Muslims are circumcised as well. So if you're going to start banning circumcision, it's going to get pretty awkward. But nevertheless, you can see that the kind of language they're using about other Jews isn't very solidaristic, is it? If Jews who support Jeremy Corbyn are traitors, according to that first guy, is that really the case?
Well, look, let's just roll back from the anti-Semitism and take a look at special needs children's education, because I know you've been involved in that over the last couple of years, Tim, and there's been a development over the last week or so.
Yes, well, finally, the report by Ofsted and the CQC into Bristol City Council's Special Educational Needs Department, and also the CCG, which is sort of the local doctor's service as well, which is part of this, has come out. It's been, I'm afraid, it's not a good report. It's no surprise that the service is in a very poor state. It's revealed quite serious failings within our Special Educational Needs Department. They have issued what's called a written statement of action. So in other words, Bristol now has 90 days to respond with an action plan on how it's going to improve.
Now, I can remember chatting to, I think it was Joss Clark about this a year or so ago, and she was saying what they discovered was that council officers had been told, do not open any emails on the subject, because as soon as you open that email, it sets a clock ticking, and that the council then have to do something about special needs for that particular person. So what was happening is people had been told to email the council. The council was leaving these in the inbox unopened, and then saying, well, actually, if we are forced to open that email, we will, and then the clock will start ticking on that specific case. So it looks to me as if there are all sorts of rather underhand tactics being employed so that people from the city council are not actually fulfilling their statutory duty to educate people with special needs.
They were doing actually even worse a month ago. They were actually deleting your email. So when you were emailed in to apply for an educational healthcare plan for your child, because you felt that they needed that additional support to access education, the department deleted emails from near mid-November and then they planned to delete them till the 6th of January, until I objected, pointed out this was an utter breach of law, and 24 hours later they stopped doing that, and they reversed the policy. But they had to put an appeal out to people for those few weeks that they've been operating it to resend their emails, because they had already actually deleted them.
This is unbelievable behaviour, really, from the council. I mean, one might even say this is a legal document. You can't just delete that. You've got a legal duty to discharge. Imagine if the police started doing that with witness statements, for example.
It was utterly in breach of the Children's and Family Act 2014.
Has the mayor had anything to say? He's in charge of all of this. Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor.
Not over that incident, but since the Ofsted report came out, which found all of the failings, a sort of apology has come out. Personally, I just feel it's not good enough. I mean, some of us have been, many parents have been raising this now for a few years. As you know, this all sort of came to a head when a £5 million cut was proposed in 1 year to special educational needs. That was taken to the High Court as a judicial review. That cut was overturned, thankfully, and not only was that money restored, but additional money was as well. But since then, no one has kept their eye on the ball. No one has recognised the problem that is within the department. There is a serious problem about funding overall from national government. I'm not pinning all of this at the current administration, not by a long way is it all their fault. But there are other councils who do have good departments, other councils who do pass these inspections, other councils who don't completely and utterly fail to respond to parents' applications for educational healthcare plans. Basically, the law states you should deal with these within 20 weeks. So if you apply for one, within 20 weeks, you should have your plan. You're now at 50 to 60 weeks plus in Bristol to have any chance to get a plan. It is shocking. Many of these children are then not in school. So we must recognise a whole year plus of children's lives are sometimes being lost because they're not in school. Many children are in school and classes are not receiving a satisfactory education they need. Many children in classes are also then not receiving a satisfactory education because some of those children in their class with special educational needs are not getting the support they need. So it's having a catastrophic effect within the education service. Not all of this is at the blame of Bristol City Council, but a good proportion is, and they need to get their act together. They need to start to tackle it.
Martin, this isn't the sort of thing we expect from a civilised country, a civilised mayor, a civilised city council, is it? Effectively depriving, actively going out to deprive disabled people and similar people with special needs of their legal right to a decent education?
Well, I totally agree. And so far as the council has been remiss in this matter, it needs to pull its socks up and get it sorted out. The fundamental problem is that there's a massive need out there. I work with special needs kids, so I'm very well aware of this. And we're always struggling because there's not enough resources. We see it all the time.
But the message coming down from on high is it's survivor of the fittest, boys and girls. If you're not fit and healthy and extremely good at stuff, then you've got to get nothing from us.
Underpinning all of this, Tony, is the politics of austerity. The local council.
Well, I thought you might come to this because I'm also looking at a story about Bristol Energy. Notwithstanding the costs and losses during 2019, Bristol City Council has increased its investment into this black hole and funding of various kinds to Bristol Energy by more than £9 million mm-hmm. to a total of nearly £38 million, blowing away a previous limit which had been set at £31 million. So at the same time as they're not funding special needs, they are funding Bristol Energy, which seems to be, I suppose we'll only know in a few years' time if we've got a crystal ball, Tim, if Bristol Energy is actually ever going to make a penny.
Well, Bristol Energy, I'm afraid, as far as the council's concerned, has been a disaster. Those aren't my words. Those are the words of the finance officer who set up the original report to Cabinet establishing Bristol Energy. Within that report, it states there are several business cases. It says under every business case, Bristol Energy makes money. Then it says, apart from the disaster business case, there is absolutely no doubt it's been a disaster. It is beyond my understanding why so much money is kept being pumped in and
in. It's £38 million so far. Should they just wind it up?
It is as if the mayor is at the roulette wheel and does not understand when to stop when the losses are too high. He should have walked away from the roulette wheel many, many months ago. There is no way we're going to get a penny of that money back. The problem we now face, of course, is the reality is the second you stop funding that company, it will go under. That's the second you've got to account for the loans that have been made to Bristol Energy in your revenue budget.
I mean,
budget.
Surely the way this thing works is you've got audit scrutiny. Mark Brain, I don't know if he's still to do with audit, but I spoke to him recently. He said, well, no one listens to this show, so I'm not coming on, or very few people. He doesn't want to come on and talk about this. He's a Labour councillor. But look, the whole point here really is, is the scrutiny actually giving any signs that Bristol Energy is going to give a return at some point, or is this just a complete waste of money?
Well, it came very recently to the Overuse Scrutiny Management Committee, which I don't sit on. They do get some additional, I believe, confidential reports. But what is in public shows that they show them, I think, basically breaking even in 2023. Then you've got a question, how do you survive between now and 2023? You only survive by more money being put in. In reality, over the last year, about 7 energy companies have gone under. Probably double that look like they're probably going to follow. Buffalo. There's been a substantial loss of money by also the one other state-run energy company, which is Nottingham Robin Hood. What we need to do now is stop putting money into this. It is a waste of council taxpayers' money. And for its customers are 88% outside of this city. So we're subsidising the energy, sometimes of rich people living hundreds of miles away from this city. It is completely unacceptable use of taxpayers' money.
What do you make of all that, Martin? Because, I mean, you know, there is a limited pot. You know, it is. It just seems as if a lot of this money is going down the drain.
Well, the company was originally set up, if you remember, under the previous regime. And I'm personally a top-down socialist. I don't believe that having small companies like this run by the public sector in competition with existing private sector companies is a viable model.
As I understand it,
it's not a viable
Tim,
business model.
It's actually,
if you want to nationalise the main energy companies, that's a different story.
As I understand it, Tim, it's like one step removed. So it is being funded by Bristol City Council, but it's not actually open in the normal way to scrutiny by councillors, as most all parts of the city council would be. So it's at arm's length, and there is, I understand, I think it's the same company that runs Bristol Waste, that you've got a board there that are making all these various decisions about where this money's going to go, but they don't file any accounts or whatever to Companies House. They come through the city council and they go in the annual audit and or the annual accounts of Bristol City Council. So it does sound halfway between a council.
It's called Bristol Holdings Limited. Right. So if you want to look it up, that is the company. It has three, I believe. So it's Bristol Waste. It is the also has the housing company, and it has Bristol Energy. It is not. There is not an acceptable amount of public scrutiny of what is going on here. It's had a disastrous business strategy where basically it tried to increase its numbers of customers by taking a loss by trying to compete on the competition websites against the big beasts. The thing is, the six big energy company have a captured market. They have the several million people who don't want to change. They can charge those people right. money and make a profit. We've then been fighting over the people you can never make a profit on, because as soon as you put their energy up, they change. Yeah. They change energy companies as soon as you put their price up. So you can never, ever make money off the customer base they have. They've now suddenly come up with a miraculous idea of switching the strategy to appeal to Bristolian residents. The strategy the company should have had right from day one.
Well, I can tell you, I've invited them on this program many times. They won't come on. They don't want to talk about it. It just seems to me they don't have the confidence in themselves, Tim.
No, well, they certainly don't have my confidence. I just think we need to draw a line under the sand. I believe that the big plan is to try to wrap this company up in the Bristol Leap, which is sort of a big energy investment plan for the city. I have my grave doubts about that. I'm just wondering, if a serious company comes along and wants to invest in this city, why on earth would they touch Bristol Energy? I think what we need to do is be realistic. What I fear is happening here is the company's been kept afloat till after May to ensure the mayor gets re-elected, so he doesn't have to face the catastrophe that he's basically been looking after. What we must remember is when this company was set up in 2015 under George Ferguson, basically not under Mayor Rees, it had a cap on the funding it should receive of £10.9 million. £10.9 million. As soon as that was hit, and it was hit far faster than it was supposed to have been, someone should have said, we're at the disaster business case. That's what we're facing. And we should close this down now.
Nobody seems to have the guts to pull the plug.
Well, I've been very clear we should pull the plug. We need to pull the plug. We then need to deal with the fallout of how we find a £37 million loss in the financial year, which will suddenly have to hit Bristol's accounts.
I mean, how much is this tied up? I mean, you've implied it is with the whole mayoral system, the idea that having one mayor in charge of all this stuff rather than councillors making these decisions together.
Well, I think it's tied up with the secrecy that we have seen under the mayoral system. Increasingly, documents are being made exempt. Increasingly, information is not flowing. Even to the leaders of political parties, they are told far less quite often they would have been consulted on quite secretive matters. These days, they're often cut out of the loop. What we have seen with the companies is, of course, they've set up boards. Then those boards have very, very little scrutiny and oversight. There is some, but again, it's being held in secret. That is not the way a democracy should be run. That is not the way we should be dealing with public funds. And actually, the government actually has been clear in the past that public companies should be open to public scrutiny. And that's what should be happening here. What we have now seen is we have now this disaster on our hands. The money is gone. It's not going to come back. This company is not going to suddenly start magically making money. There's 65 other energy companies out there, many of them in very poor situations. The big beasts still dominate the market. There is no way we're going to compete against them. That has been proven. What we now need to do is draw up a strategy on how we can minimise the losses
this,
to the taxpayer.
This £38 million, what would it have done in the education budget?
Well, I think you can ask yourself a lot of what £38 million would have done. I mean, the reality is £38 million would have built you five new schools, perhaps five new special schools. Hundreds of children who are currently not in school could now be in school. And ironically, we could have then reduced down the cost of the special educational needs budget because it relies heavily on independent schools who provide specialist services. Those services can be very, very expensive. So overall, what we could have done is we could have seen a transformation in our offer of special educational needs through using that money's capital funding, because obviously if you use one-off money as revenue, you quickly run out of money. There is no doubt we're not going to get that money back. We must stop funding Bristol Energy.
Martin, this is a company which is halfway between actually something which is working directly for the council, specifically with, for example, a board made up of councillors and scrutinised in public up at City Hall, the council house, whatever it's called these days, and a private business which is secretive.
Well, I used to be a development worker in the social economy section at the council, so I'm very well aware of the kind of ambivalent hypocrisy surrounding the so-called third sector, because what actually they're supposedly not the bureaucratic top-down council type stuff, but they're not the private sector either. They've got other goals, but in actual fact they ultimately come down to being sort of white elephants like this
is actually an example, I think, of quite a lot of business ideas being brought into the public
well,
sector.
This is the point I was going to make about, we're talking about mayoral system, that I think Marvin has inherited George's idea that the mayor is some kind of, he's going to do all of these kind of new innovative things. And in actual fact, what we really need to see in Bristol is just holding the line on doing the basic things that councils need to do, like special needs. We don't need big ideas. In another circumstance with a different kind of government, you could decentralise decision making to this level and innovate. But when we're just struggling to keep the basic stuff going, we really just need a grin and bear it. Get down and do your basic job.
It will be very
stuff.
Interesting to see what Marvin Rees has got to say about this in the mayoral elections.
I just wanted to point out, I think there's only one councillor who actually sits on the board.
Amazing. Anyway, thanks to our guests. That's Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Join me after the US-owned Comcast news at 7 as we take our weekly
this
look around the world.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.